In our final story this week, we turn to the experience of another American who went to Africa to teach, but also to be taught. 50 years ago, near the beginning of the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King went to Ghana, a country then just gaining its independence from Great Britain, and he found that Ghana had a lot to teach African Americans about their own struggle. Recently, we had the opportunity to speak with Professor Claiborne Carson, director of the Martin Luther King Papers Project at Stanford. He begins our story about the trip King took to Ghana in 1957 and how it affected him and the American Civil Rights Movement.
Well, he was invited by Kwame Nkrumah, who became the first president of Ghana and prime minister, I guess. And he had invited King to come to the independence ceremony. This was in 1957. And King, along with other African American leaders, attended and was very impressed by it, inspired. In some ways, the African struggle, when Africans succeeded in achieving independence in Ghana and other countries in sub-Saharan Africa, that spurred the African-American struggle. You know, the idea was that if Africans can be running countries, why are we still trying to get the right to vote? Well, Martin Luther King had always been very aware of the African anti-colonial struggle, and he had always linked that struggle to the movement in the United States. He saw them both as freedom struggles, and he understood that a lot of the inspiration for the African-American struggle came from the African continent, and also many of the African leaders had drawn inspiration from people like Marcus Garvey, and even Booker T. Washington had been a great influence. W.E.B. Du Bois was a pioneering Pan-African. He had been involved in the Pan-African movement for all of the 20th century. And, of course, Martin Luther King was very aware of Du Bois. So that was an essential part of his philosophy, that he saw these movements as interrelated.
In 1957, Ghana threw off Great Britain's colonial rule. The new president, Kwame Nkrumah, invited Martin Luther King to be part of the independence celebration. King found the ceremony deeply moving, and the idea of African independence significant to the struggle at home. When he returned to Montgomery, he addressed his congregation with a sermon on his experiences in Ghana. Reading this sermon is Awele Amekiba, an actress who specializes in portraying and examining the United States civil rights movement.
And I want to take just a few more minutes as I close to say three or four things that this reminds me of, and things that it says to us. Things that we must never forget as we ourselves find ourselves breaking loose from an evil Egypt, trying to move through the wilderness toward the promised land of cultural interrogation. Ghana has something to say to us. It says to us first that the oppressor never voluntarily gives freedom to the oppressed. You have to work for it. And if Nkrumah and the people of the Gold Coast had not stood up persistently, revolting against the system, it would still be a colony of the British Empire. Freedom is never given to anybody, for the oppressor has you in domination because he plans to keep you there, and he never voluntarily gives it up. And that is where the strong resistance comes. Privileged classes never give up their privileges without strong resistance.
So the struggle of the 20th century is a struggle of people in that condition to try to better their lives, to try to gain basic human rights. And to some degree, that's what all the freedom struggles were about. It's from going from being nobody to be being disregarded by those in power, by having no opportunities, by having no rights that a white person need respect, by not really being citizens of whatever you happen to be living. You know, that's the fate of most Asian and African people until the 20th century.
As Professor Carson just said, a common understanding of class struggle arose on a global level in the 20th century. Ethnic and national freedom movements across the world shared a common thread in that they all were undertaken by people of the lower classes, demanding social and economic equality. In that way, the freedom struggles in Ghana and other parts of the colonized world had close ties with the civil rights movement in the United States. As the most visible figure of the Montgomery boycott in 1955, King played a key role motivating his congregation and the civil rights movement in the struggle for political power. This sermon, given just after he returned from Ghana to the United States, was no exception.
So don't go out this morning with any illusions. Don't go back into your homes and around Montgomery thinking that the Montgomery City Commission and all of the other forces in the leadership of the South will eventually work out this thing for Negroes. It's going to work out. It's going to roll in on the wheels of inevitability. If we wait for it to work out, it will never be worked out. Freedom only comes through persistent revolt, through persistent agitation, through persistently rising up against the system of evil. The bus protest is just the beginning. Buses are integrated in Montgomery, but that is just the beginning. And don't just sit down and do nothing now because the buses are integrated. Because if you stop now, we will be in the dungeons of segregation and discrimination for another 100 years. And our children and our children's children will suffer all of the bondage that we have lived under for years. It never comes voluntarily. We've got to keep on keeping on in order to gain freedom. It never comes like that. It would be fortunate if the people in power had sense enough to go on and give up. But they don't do it like that. It is not done voluntarily, but it is done through the pressure that comes about from people who are oppressed.
King's words were prophetic. Direct resistance against unjust laws would soon be a cause championed, challenged, and cherished throughout the nation. And there's no question that the same resistance was happening in Africa and in places all over the world at the same time. What's so inspiring about listening to these speeches today is that the message is still so powerful. Nonviolent political action is just as relevant now as it was then. King touched on the power of nonviolence in his sermon.
If there had not been a Gandhi in India with all his noble followers, India would have never been free. If there had not been an Nkrumah and his followers in Ghana, Ghana would still be a British colony. And if there had not been abolitionists in America, both Negro and white, we might still stand today in the dungeons of slavery. And then because there have been in every period, there are always those people in every period of human history who don't mind getting their necks cut off, who don't mind being persecuted and discriminated and kicked about because they know that freedom is never given out, but it comes through the persistent and the continual agitation and revolt on the part of those who are caught in the system. Ghana teaches us that. It says to us another thing. It reminds us of the fact that a nation or a people can break loose from oppression without violence. And Nkrumah says in the first two pages of his autobiography, which was published on the 6th of March, a great book which you ought to read, he said that he had studied the special systems of social philosophers, and he started studying the life of Gandhi and his techniques. And he said that in the beginning, he could not see how they could get a loose from a colonialism without armed revolt, without armies and ammunition rising up. Then he says, after he continued to study Gandhi and continued to study his technique, he came to see that the only way was through nonviolent positive action, and he called his program positive action. And it's a beautiful thing, isn't it? That here is a nation that is now free, and it is free without rising up with arms and ammunition. It is free through nonviolent means. Because of that, the British Empire will not have the bitterness for Ghana that she has for China, so to speak, Because of that, when the British Empire leaves Ghana, she leaves with a different attitude than she would have left with if she had been driven out by armies. We've got to revolt in such a way that after revolt is over, we can live with people as brothers and as sisters. Our aim must never be to defeat them or humiliate them.
Now, during the 20th century, we've had two major campaigns, one of them the anti-colonial struggle, and the other the more general struggle against, I guess what I would call the legal system of racial suppression. There's a similarity in those struggles that that links us together. And many of the tactics, the development of both revolutionary tactics and nonviolent tactics, are very similar in terms of the, when Nkrumah was using, positive resistance and in the South African struggle, they were influenced by Gandhi. As similarly in the American struggle, the Gandhian influence as well as the influence of Bolshevism and the idea of a revolutionary struggle against colonialism. I think both of all those currents, all those ideological and tactical discussions took place throughout the Pan-African world.
While King was in Ghana, Etta Barnett interviewed him on the Ghanaian radio. It was just after the midnight independence celebrations on March 6, 1957. Here, King talks about the worldwide implications of Ghana's independence. According to King, later that night, the new Prime Minister, Kwame Nkrumah, remarked that Ghana would never be able to accept the American ideology of freedom and democracy fully until America settles its own internal racial strife. In the story of this one evening celebration in Accra, we see the overlap between the freedom movements in Africa and America.
I think this event, the birth of this new nation, will give impetus to oppressed peoples all over the world. I think it will have worldwide implications and repercussions, not only for Asia and Africa, but also for America. As you well know, we have a problem in the Southland in America, and I think this freedom, the freedom and the birth of a new nation, will influence the situation there. This will become a sort of symbol for oppressed people all over the world, Just as in 1776, when America received its independence, a harbor of New York became a sort of beacon of hope for thousands of oppressed people of Europe, and just as when, after the French Revolution, Paris became a beacon of hope for hundreds and thousands of common people, now Ghana will become a symbol of hope for hundreds and thousands of oppressed people all over the world, Africa and in Asia, and also oppressed peoples in other sections of the world as they struggle for freedom.
King expressed that hope in his sermon as well, and Professor Carson reflects on what this sermon means for us today.
On the night of the state ball, standing up talking with some people, Mordecai Johnson called my attention to the fact that Prime Minister Kwame Nkrumah was there dancing with the Duchess of Kent, and I said, "Isn't this something? Here is the one serf, the one slave, now dancing with the Lord on an equal plane, and that is done because there is no bitterness. These two nations will be able to live together and work together because the breaking of loose was through nonviolence and not through violence. The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community. The aftermath of nonviolence is redemption. The aftermath of nonviolence is reconciliation. The aftermath of violence are emptiness and bitterness. This is the thing I'm concerned about. Let us fight passionately and unrelentingly for the goals of justice and peace. But let's be sure that our hands are clean in the struggle. Let us never fight with falsehood and violence and hate and malice, but always fight with love, so that when the day comes that the walls of segregation have completely crumbled in Montgomery, that we will be able to live with people as their brothers and sisters."
Well, I think that one of the things that's true about the world in general is that we assume that that the West has something to teach the rest of the world, but I think it's often the rest of the world that truly gets the message. That is, you know, what Gandhi once said about Christianity, that it would be, you know, a nice religion and those in the West should try practicing it. You know, it's you know, a lot of Western ideals are just that, they're ideals that haven't been realized. And I think there's a complacency about that. You know, that's the way the rest of the world looks at us. I mean, they see through the pretensions about democracy and the way in which we have one of the lowest rates of political participation in the world. In this country, many countries have a much higher rate of participation, and in many cases, the laws in this country are specifically designed to encourage or discourage participation. So we have a long way to go to realize the promise of democracy, and I think the rest of the world might point the way.
We don't often think of Africa as exercising its influence on the United States. But if King's sermon is any evidence, we owe Africa a great deal. The struggles of Ghana and other African countries for independence undoubtedly became part of the global struggle against class oppression, a struggle that would inspire King and other civil rights activists to lead the United States into a new era.